From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The governor calls the news media a bunch of Eeyores because of gloomy views of his administration.
When you're kind of down in the dumps as an elected official, the media is a pretty good target. I mean, it's serving Donald Trump pretty well.
Michigan leaders gather for the Mackinac Policy Conference, but barely mention the biggest Michigan story of the year, Flint.
Most folks have come to the conclusion that we just haven't gotten nearly enough help.
It's summer. Use sunscreen. Take it from a guy who knows.
The thing with melanoma is it's a real SOB to treat.
And since you'll be sitting in the shade from now on, we've got a cocktail for you.
This is the sort of thing you'd want to be careful not to have too many while you're sitting on your patio, or you might fall off.
Those stories and our first report in a new series on mental health. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. If a teenager tells you they're thinking about suicide, would you know where to go for help? Later in the hour, we'll speak with a Lansing area mother who tried to get emergency help for her 16-year-old son, but when she reached out, she feels the system failed her. Now she's speaking out and calling for change. We'll have her powerful story a little later in the hour. But first, the Detroit Regional Chamber's Mackinac Policy Conference wrapped up this morning. Joining us to talk a little bit about that and other news are Susan Demas, she's the publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, and Ken Sikkema, a senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants. So apparently there was a lot of buzz on Mackinac Island about an epic MRA poll which finds Governor Snyder's disapproval rating is 52%. Susan, what's that say about the voters' view of the governor these days?
I don't think the numbers are very surprising. He's taken body blow after body blow over the Flint water crisis, and he has just yet to recover or come up with a compelling message. So I'm not sure that he's hit the lowest point of his governorship either.
Ken, as a former elected official, what kind of credence do you give to approval ratings, or in this case, disapproval ratings?
Well, you know, you should be concerned about them. I mean, they're kind of a snapshot in time, so you don't get obsessed with them. I mean, they shouldn't keep you awake at night if you're an elected official, because they're going to go up and down. But I think this one is it's a little different because of the Flint issue and people's reaction to his leadership or lack of leadership dealing with that issue. So this one might be a little deeper, but you can't let it consume you.
The governor has indicated Michigan needs to embrace a little of his relentless positive action. I'm wondering what each of you thinks of that approach, his approach, and whether that works as well in government as it did for him when he was in the private sector.
I think that he's finding it harder and harder to sell that relentless positive action message in light of the Flint water crisis and just the growing discontent that governors face in year six in the last part of their tenure. That's a message that he would like everybody to pick up on. And he was very critical of the media for only focusing on negative things going on in Michigan. But the reality is, if you look at poll numbers, people are very dissatisfied with the governor and where things are going in the state. And a lot of people are upset about the state of things in the country.
Ken, it's been suggested that because he insists on relentless positive action, that possibly some of the people in his administration were afraid to bring him bad news like what was happening in Flint. Do you think that has an impact on how he's been able to govern?
Well, I think it does. Relentless positive action is just, it's getting old as a phrase, in part because of the sort of disasters like Flint. I mean, you know, that was done under relentless positive action. So it's just getting old. And I think he ought to sort of abandon it. And I also think that it's going to be a long time before Michigan voters elect an outside CEO business type. I think it's going to have some impact on the kind of candidates that are going to be seen as viable in the, at least the near term. You know, and for the record and for transparency's sake, I co-chaired the Flint Water Advisory Task Force, and one of our findings was that he had a very kind of narrow information flow coming to him, and that might have served for efficiency, and he probably brought it to state government from his experience in the private sector. But in politics, you need to have multiple information flows to make sure you're getting a real sense of what's happening. And that was one of our findings and one of our recommendations, that he changes the way he operates.
The governor also says part of the problem is that the news media are a bunch of Eeyores, Winnie the Pooh's gloomy donkey friend. It seems recently politicians find blaming reporters goes over pretty well with some voters, possibly that audience at Mackinac Island. How well do you think this will work for the governor? Susan?
I think that reporters are rather unpopular with the public, and you rarely pay a price for bashing the media. It's not like reporters are going to suddenly stop covering the governor, even if he's not particularly friendly to them. And given the governor's own problems with the public, as you can see in the poll numbers, trying to make the media into a sort of villain is probably not a bad technique. Certainly, it's worked for Donald Trump. He's far more hostile to the media than Governor Snyder is. But I would expect that given the coverage he's received, given the beating he's taken in the polls, he's probably going to continue being this prickly.
The speech that he gave at the Mackinac Policy Conference was supposed to be sort of a reset for the governor. Do you think kind of labeling the media as Eeyores is a good first step?
Well, I agree with Susan. When you're kind of down in the dumps as an elected official, the media is a pretty good target. And as she said, I mean, it's serving Donald Trump pretty well. I don't think it particularly helps reestablish an active agenda. I don't think it helps to focus on problems that need to get solved and figuring out a way to solve them. I think the governor is sort of laboring under kind of two liabilities here. One is the one we've already talked about, and that is the Flint hangover. But the other is, and Susan hinted at this, is he's in the last 2.5 years of his last term, and all governors sort of run into agenda fatigue, the inability to get stuff done, and that's a liability here. So he's got those two kind of working against him, and labeling the media the way he did isn't going to help or solve that problem.
That's Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants, and Susan Demas, publisher and editor of Inside Michigan Politics. They joined us via Skype. Thanks, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, since we're on the topic of the Mackinac Policy Conference, let's go to Mackinac Island and hear from Michigan Radio's Zoe Clark. She, of course, is the co-host of It's Just Politics. So with the Flint water crisis all over the news in this state, across the country, around the world, you would think it would be a big, big topic at the conference. But as I understand from some attendees, it was kind of light on the topic of lead contamination in the city. Is that what you saw?
Yeah, absolutely, Lester. I mean, there was really only one formal panel at the conference that dealt with Flint, and that was actually only scheduled late last week as another panel had been canceled last minute. And that also kind of continued into what Governor Snyder was saying throughout the conference, just kind of pushing this narrative that he's ready to move on, that folks shouldn't continue to talk about the problems that led to Flint, but instead, you know, look to the future and how he can fix things or the state can fix things.
Yeah, we just talked with Susan Demas and Ken Sikkema about the governor wanting to keep things positive. Did you get a chance to talk to the governor about that?
Yeah, I did. I had a sit down with the governor yesterday, you know, so I had a few minutes to talk to him about Flint. And here's just one thing that he had to say.
It was a terrible thing to have happen. In many respects, I think if you look at on the ground, most of the effort's on the recovery, on how to, you know, put solutions in place. And when I talk to people in Flint, a lot of people want to see things made better. And there's still a lot of this narrative of people talking about the past or making it negative. In a lot of ways, one of the important things long term is to get Flint viewed as a terrible thing that happened, but how that community can be stronger longer term. Because ultimately, we clearly need to address the water question, both short, intermediate, and long term. But to really strengthen Flint, it's about making it an attractive place for job creation and put Flint people to work in terms of good career opportunities. And so that's something that we need to get to that dialogue, and I would hope that's what you're going to hear from the people of Flint themselves.
There were plenty of folks who were not happy with this idea of the governor saying, let's just move forward. One of them is Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee. As we know, he represents Flint kind of in the thick of it. We talked about his concerns about the governor and his handling of Flint, but we also talked about the role that the city played here at the conference over the past few days.
Well, I'm most encouraged by the informal conversations that are taking place about Flint because there's, I think, near universal dissatisfaction with the level of support for Flint's recovery. Everywhere I go, people talk about Flint and want to know how's it going. And it gives a chance for us to have a conversation about what real support has been provided. And most folks have come to the conclusion that we just haven't gotten nearly enough help.
Why is that?
From, you know, my own view, it's a failure of leadership. Let me put it this way. The recovery, the efforts to help Flint recover, feel a lot like the conditions that caused the crisis in the first place. Indifference. You know, we'll get to it. Don't worry. You know, this sense that a crisis that is happening in real time can be placed on the legislative calendar is, I'd like to use a more thoughtful term, but it's kind of stupid. I mean, if you're going to spend whatever number, $170 million, to help a community come out of a crisis, it might not matter to the legislature when they deliver that support. But for the people of Flint, it could be the difference between survival and not surviving. Right now, when you go to Flint, you still can't drink the water, and nobody has any certainty that all this talk, all these promises, are going to translate into any real help.
And yet the governor says we're all too focused on these negative aspects and that it is time to move forward.
I absolutely believe that that's his position. I think that relentless positive action or whatever, maybe RPA stands for relax people already. I don't know. But I'm sure he feels that we should all stop talking about it. And we should focus on how beautiful the view is from the porch of Mackinac Island. You know what? My patience is gone.
You sound angry.
I'm very angry. I'm a Flint kid. You know, I grew up in that town. Everything I am, you know, everything I believe in, all my experiences, my childhood, the generosity of that community contributed to everything I have right now. And so to see it become sort of a talking point and to try to sort of minimize the suffering that's happening in that city by saying, you know, we have a 75-point plan. Yeah, great. How about a 390-point plan? What difference does it make? Get the help to the people of Flint. You know, so the failure of the legislature to act and the failure of the governor to insist that they act is having consequences for our ability to get federal help. You know, and I am angry.
So you can see there, or hear there, I should say, Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee angry about Flint, although I do say see because I was sitting, you know, next to him there talking, and he is frustrated. He's angry about what he really thinks is this slow process in the state's handling of the crisis.
That's Zoe Clark. She's co-host of It's Just Politics, and she's up at Mackinac Island. Thanks very much, Zoe.
Thank you, Lester.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Food and Drug Administration is changing the design of the nutrition labels on food you buy. To give us an idea of what changes, why the changes, and when we'll see those changes is Laura Bix. She's a packaging professor at Michigan State University. You were the author of a study on how the Nutrition Facts Panel can be improved. How well did the government listen to studies such as yours?
Well, I think they made an excellent first step. They've made several changes that I think will make nutrition information more useful to people and more understandable for people. Where my study looked was a lot of formatting information. We looked at how we could improve what's called early stage processing, that is, get people's attention and make them sort of engage with the nutrition information. The government more concentrated on late stage processing. How do we make things more understandable and easier to use? And so I think they've done a great job at doing that. And I think there's more to be done still.
One of the things that really stands out on this new label is the fact that calories are in really big font and the serving size is a lot larger and a little more easy to see. Why did they choose to go that route?
Well, the Nutrition Facts Panel hadn't been revised for 20 years, and the law requires that the serving sizes are not based on what we should eat, but what we are eating. And when they looked at serving size 20 years later, they found that we're actually eating bigger serving sizes than maybe some of those labels were based on. So to kind of ease the mental gymnastics that people had to go through in order to get accurate calorie counts, some of those serving sizes, like ice cream, moved from a half cup, which I don't know about you, but I don't generally sit down and eat a half cup of ice cream.
Everybody eats a pint.
Well, yes, they did. They didn't go quite that far, but they've moved it up to 2/3 of a cup. And so the idea is that they're giving you a more realistic sort of measure of what you'll be consuming than maybe they were before, so you don't have to do all that math.
You mentioned ice cream. Let's talk about fat in foods. Understanding the kinds of fat that are in foods makes a real difference. What will we see changed on the new label regarding fat content?
Well, in terms of fat, it's not so much about the amount of fat, but the type of fat. And so, again, the government's sort of using sort of scientifically based studies, and they're saying, okay, it's really not the amount of fat that you consume, but the type of fat that you consume. They'll be specifically calling out trans fats and saturated fats so that people are more aware of what type as opposed to just how much in general.
Now, there's been some listing of those separate fats. How is it different on the new label?
With regard to that, I believe it's that they're calling out the saturated fats in particular. And again, not emphasizing the overall amount anymore, but sort of subdividing it into these particular types.
Okay. So sugars have always been confusing. How does the new label improve a consumer's ability to figure out not just how much added sugar, but how much sugar is in the product?
Well, it's more type than total amount. And one of the new additions, probably one of the most contested additions to the label, is the idea of added sugars. Research has shown that if we're consuming more than 10% of our calories from added sugars, it's going to be very difficult to eat the types of nutrients that we need to eat and stay within the calorie sort of limit that we should be consuming. That is, that we're more prone to obesity if we're consuming a large portion of our calories from added sugars. And so the labels now call out specifically the sugars that have been added. So these are not naturally occurring sugars that might be added from dairy products or fruit products, but things that have been processed. So it's a more transparent sort of view of your food.
Right. I was reading an article not too long ago. I couldn't believe some of the foods that I eat that actually have added sugar. I mean, everything from breads to some really savory products that you wouldn't think about sugar being in them. So what do you think this will do for someone trying to understand how to make their diet more healthful? Because it's still not exactly simple. It is simpler, but not simple.
And that goes back to kind of my first statement. I think it's a great first step. And I think for people that are motivated to engage with the information, the FDA has done a really good job of enhancing the transparency, of trying to make the labels more understandable and useful. Where I think we can go a little bit farther is people that maybe aren't as deeply involved or deeply engaged in labeling. I think great next steps would be something like a front-of-pack nutrition label. These truncate the nutrition facts panel and call out specific nutrients that tend to be tied to disease states, things like saturated fat, sodium, and sugar, on the front of the package. And in doing so, some of our research suggests that they engage people that might not likely engage with nutrition information otherwise because of their prominence and placement on the package.
When will we start seeing these new labels?
Well, I would like to say soon. You do see them some, but they are not regulated at present, and that lack of regulation at present opens up the possibility for non-standardization and potentially misuse of the information. So I think it'll be a while, but I would not be surprised at all if FDA doesn't turn their attention to it now that they've overhauled the nutrition facts panel.
Laura Bix is a professor at Michigan State University. Thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. There are few things scarier than hearing your doctor say you have cancer. David Stanley heard those words. He was diagnosed with melanoma. What did he do? Well, he survived, and he wrote a book about the experience, and more importantly, a warning to you. David Stanley's book is Melanoma, It Started with a Freckle, and he joins us now. So when did you first realize this might be something more than a freckle?
I never really did realize that it might be more than a freckle, Lester. What happened was, is my wife leaned in to give me a kiss, what I thought was going to be a kiss at dinner one night, and it was not a kiss at all. She was saying, you have this weird thing right in front of your ear. And I'm like, weird thing? Weird how? You know, fuzz, dirt, what? And she said, no, I'm a nurse. I'm wearing my nurse's hat right now. You need to have that looked at. That's not good. She said, no, this doesn't look good at all.
So you went in to the doctor, confirmed, had the biopsy, all of that. And I want to skip forward a little bit
sure.
because you got rid of it and then it came back. And that's when things really get scary.
Right. Cancer, you know, one of the things that I heard from one of the surgeons that I met with along the way is your best shot is always your first shot. And anytime cancer comes back, that's never good. And it not only came back, it came back bigger in the exact same place.
This is the thing that really gets me. I mean, fortunately, I've not had this experience, but what's your reaction when you hear news that you might have something that's life-threatening and immediate?
It scares the crap out of you. It is an instant life changer. It is a game-changing moment. And it doesn't matter whether it's what kind of skin cancer it is, what other kind of cancer it is. When you're faced with that moment where you're going, I know I'm going to die sometime, but this is, you know, a immediate threat. It's a really terrifying moment.
And how did you deal with it?
I freaked out several times. In the book, I detailed three or four different instances where I just had total meltdowns, one before the actual surgery, several in the biopsies. One thing I did try to do to keep both oars in the water was I tried to maintain some kind of workout schedule. I raced bicycles for a living when I was a kid, and I've always tried to stay really active, and that was a huge help. It's a very meditative kind of thing to get your mind off of that.
Now, we've been using the term melanoma, but let's just call it what it is. It's skin cancer,
right.
And it's becoming a larger problem. It's one of the most dangerous and deadliest cancers. Why is it becoming a larger problem when we're seeing fewer incidents of other kinds of cancers?
There's two big reasons for that, Lester. First of all is we are getting very good at dealing with the typical things that kill us as we age into our 50s and 60s. Cardiovascular disease is down. Stroke is down. Deaths from other kinds of cancer are down. So we're getting very good at dealing with those sorts of things. The other side of that is a very much environmental kind of thing. We have done a very good job of destroying our best ultraviolet filter.
And, of course, because of that, there's more ultraviolet radiation, and almost all cases of melanoma are related to increased doses of UV rays. Over the past 50, 60 years, there's been this tanning craze that's been going on. You were athletic. You tanned in college. You
Yep.
did all the things that your doctor is probably telling you was a really bad idea. And I have to say, you're very fair-skinned.
Yes. My family's from Lithuania and Ukraine way back in the day, and I am the poster child for everything to not do to prevent getting skin cancer as you get older in life.
And we're seeing a lot of this, but everybody has this false feeling of being protected by sunscreens. And sunscreens, depending on what ones you buy, can be just disastrous in the fact that they don't do what they're intended to do.
Right. Many of the sunscreens that are out there, when they are subject to really intense scrutiny by professionals, don't have the advertised amount of SPF. And I want to just back up for one second. You mentioned the tanning craze.
Mm-hmm.
That's also been a huge, huge cause for the spike in skin cancers. There are more cases of skin cancer now caused by tanning than there are cases of lung cancer caused by smoking.
Wow. So a lot of people have been faced with melanoma during their lives. They didn't write books. You did. Why?
Two reasons. One is by nature, I'm a storyteller. I'm a school teacher, and the way I taught high school and the way I got kids into my world of science and a bit of English that I taught was by telling stories. So I've always told stories, and this seemed like a perfect story because 95% of the time, melanoma is preventable. And what I went through was, I wouldn't say hell, because I've seen some people that were higher level of suffering with their melanoma than what I went through. Most of my terror was of my own making and inside my own head.
Let's talk about what people should be aware of so that if they do have a problem, a new freckle, as you say, they're aware of what to look for and when they should go see the doctor.
Right. There are, of course, the ABCDEs of skin cancer self-diagnosis. But the problem with those ABCDEs, and that's what is out there for most of the layman, is not everything that's positive for that is melanoma. And many kinds of melanoma aren't positive for that. It works both ways. What you're looking for, and this is one of the great things about the dermatologist that I went to and the U of M clinic here in town at the multiple disciplinary melanoma clinic, you're looking for what they call the lone wolf. We all make stuff on our skin, especially as we get older, and melanoma still is primarily a disease of people over 40. We all make stuff, little skin tags, little, you know, pigment markings, all of that. When you see something in an exposed area that doesn't match up with the other things that you normally make, that's the real warning sign.
So what are the ABCDEs?
Right. We're looking for things that are asymmetric. For example, if you have a mole and one side is nice and round and the other side looks like a bean, if you draw a line through the middle of it, if it's not symmetrical from side to side, that's strike one. Strike two is the border. Normally, a mole has got a very nice smooth border. If your border of your particular mole or skin thing is kind of jagged, kind of sawtooth, erose, that's another warning sign. Coloration. Most non-cancerous moles are one color. In my case, what Kath noticed was that my mole was three different colors. That was the thing that tipped her off. Diameter. Most cancerous moles are more than 1 centimeter in size, but not all of them. So if you have some of the other things and it's still small, mine was relatively small, that's another warning sign. E is evolving. If it's been very normal and all of a sudden it looks different, that's a warning sign.
And as I understand it, a mole that you might have had since you were a kid could also start changing.
Absolutely. If that mole is changing, you need to get help, because the thing with melanoma is it's a real SOB to treat. It spreads out under the layers of skin far more quickly than often the mole on the surface changes. So while you're saying, I should probably have this looked at, it doesn't look right, it's already starting to spread. And melanoma is very dangerous because it wants to go home to your brain. Melanoma cells, melanocytes, are from the same basic kinds of tissue that your brain is from. And so what happens is as the melanoma starts to spread, it looks for others of its own kind. And that's what almost killed President Carter, was the melanocytes that were cancerous went home to his brain, set up shop in his brain, and it's the melanoma tumors in your brain that typically are the fatal ones.
So since your book has come out, have people come to you and said, hey, I'm glad I read that because I found I had a problem?
That's a very interesting question. I've had 18 people that wrote blurbs for this book, and they are, you know, folks from all over the map, healthcare professionals, other authors, folks in the news. 5 of them have messaged me out of 18 to say, I had a weird thing that I didn't pay any attention to. I made an appointment to see the doctor. 4 of them were meaningless. 1 of them was malignant.
Wow.
And considering 1 out of 50 of us is going to get melanoma, 1 out of 50, 2% of the population, I'd say that's pretty good numbers right there.
David Stanley is author of the book Melanoma, It Started with a Freckle. Thanks for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you very much, Lester. I appreciate it.
And now it's time for a cocktail with Tammy Coxon of Tammy's Tastings.
Cheers.
Cheers.
So it almost feels like summer. What kind of drink do you have for us?
Well, it's after Memorial Day, and so now you can wear white and drink patio drinks. So we have a great patio drink today. It's from a bartender named Liz Cosby, and she developed this to be the perfect drink for a hot summer's day.
She's a Michigan bartender?
She is. She's the beverage director at Rock City Eatery, which has been in Hamtramck and is about to move to Detroit.
What makes this a patio drink?
Well, it's really light and refreshing. This is the Love Interruption. So it starts off with some thyme. The thyme in my garden is going crazy right now, so this is a great way to use it. I'm going to take a couple sprigs of thyme and muddle them with 1/2 ounce of simple syrup. Liz assured me that thyme is a cooling herb, so it will help you cool down on the patio. Then I'm adding 1.5 ounces of a elderflower vodka from Valentine Distillery in Ferndale, followed up with 1/2 ounce of Cointreau, and then 2 ounces of grapefruit juice. That's going to be why it's so light and refreshing. Give it a good shake, strain it into a glass with some fresh ice, tall glass. Garnish it with some thyme sprigs if you want it to look fancy.
Well, it tastes delicious. It's the first time I've ever had it. How would you describe it?
Just bright and refreshing, really easy to drink. This is the sort of thing you'd want to be careful not to have too many while you're sitting on your patio, or you might fall off.
Or not be able to get out of the Adirondack chair. All right, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Cheers.
We always want to hear from you. What stories are you looking at? What issues do you want to hear more about? Let us know. Find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside. We're also on Twitter, at Stateside Radio, and, of course, at MichiganRadio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today, we're bringing you the first report of a series called Minding Michigan. Stateside will bring you occasional reports on mental health issues in the state. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the second leading cause of death among people between the ages of 15 and 34 is suicide. Overall, suicides have been rising. Since 1999, the rate of suicide has gone up 25%. Now, the data make it abstract, but we're talking about real people and the loved ones they leave behind. And I want to introduce you to Julie Hartley. Julie lost her son, Ian, on May 2nd. He was 16. So, Julie, first, I'm really sorry for your loss. Tell us what kind of guy your son, Ian, was.
Ian was a great kid. Pretty much you would classify him as an all-American boy. He was well-liked in school. He did well in school. He was athletic. He played soccer pretty much year-round for the high school and for a travel league as well. His other interests included longboarding, and he was just getting into photography. So whenever he was on his longboard, he took his camera with him and was always trying to capture different landscaping and try to maneuver with filters and learning about that kind of stuff, just really starting to dabble into that sort of thing. Just an all-around good kid.
So when did you start to notice that Ian was struggling?
He came to me around January, the beginning of the year, and had said, you know, Mom, I really think that I need to talk to you about some depression issues. I feel like I'm struggling. I'm having trouble concentrating in school, and I feel sad all the time, and I'm having thoughts of hurting myself. I don't think I would, but I'm having those thoughts, and I just wanted to let you know. At that point, we immediately took him to his family doctor and talked with her about, you know, how he was feeling.
And did you get follow-up treatment from there?
From there, we started him on medication. So we started one medication, and after a couple of weeks, it didn't really seem to be helping at all. And so we went back to his family doctor. We upped the dose that she had originally given him. And after about 2 or 3 weeks, we really started noticing he was starting to be a little bit more himself. So we thought that that was a good change. We thought, okay, we found something that's going to work, and this is going to, you know, eventually get him back on the right track. Because it takes about 6 weeks for medicine to really start to get your dopamine levels back up to where they need to be at.
Something changed on May 1. Can you tell us what happened that day?
Well, it kind of started actually a couple of weeks before that. He started regressing again. We noticed a change, and his girlfriend sent me a message that said the day before she had called him, and he was on the overpass by his dad's house crying, and she had went and picked him up at that point and was really upset and had told her he had stopped taking his medicine. So his father and I knew at that point we needed to intervene a little bit more. So we started making sure every night we gave him his medicine and watched him take it, and then we called and got him into a counselor, thinking that was the next logical step. His first counseling session, he responded well to and said that he really liked it, and he thought that it would help. So we were hopeful for that part. Then we come to May 1st, where we had an incident that set him over the edge.
When you say over the edge, he was yelling, he was crying?
He was yelling. I went to his dad's house after I got out of work because I knew that he was upset about the situation. At that point, he just said he didn't care about getting healthy. He was going to kill himself. It didn't matter what treatment we got him. He would say and do whatever he needed to do to get out of that treatment so that he could come home and take his life. At that point, I knew that this was way beyond what we could control. I stepped out of the room at that point, and I called 911 and said, we need some help. they sent two Eaton County officers to our home, and as soon as they showed up, Ian immediately shut down. He calmed right down and did basically what he said he was going to do, which was he was going to say and do whatever he needed to be able to get back home. The officers asked him if they would give him any problems with us going to CMH because he was a minor.
Which is the community mental health center in Lansing.
In Lansing, correct. Yes, because he was a minor, they said they could not transport him. So his father and I put him in the car, and we took him to the community mental health in Lansing. That's the closest one to where we live. We got there. There was an intake person there. She asked us what was going on, and we explained the situation and how out of control he was, and he had just kept repeating that he was going to take his life and kill himself, and he didn't want to be here. We also told her he was going to say and do whatever he needed to do to be able to get back home so that he could complete that task.
What did he say while he was there?
Well, she turned to him and asked, is what your parents saying true? And he said, yes. She said, do you have a plan? And he said, yes, I'm going to jump off a bridge. And she said, okay. Then she asked us for our insurance information. We handed her our insurance card, and she said, we don't take private insurance. Private insurance doesn't cover the cost here at our facility. Let me go and get the doctor so he can talk to you. So the therapist at that point came out and said, you know, we don't take private insurance. Just for us to even talk to him, it will cost you $700 out of pocket. Go to the emergency room and you'll receive the same services there.
Oh, okay.
And I said, are you sure they will give us a psych eval and a 72-hour hold? He said, yes. And I said, does it matter what emergency room we go to? And he said, no. Every emergency room in the state of Michigan offers those services. If they see somebody in this condition, they have to service you.
So you went to the closest one, I understand, McLaren Greater Lansing Hospital. What did they tell you when you entered the ER?
We entered the ER. We sat there for a few minutes, and then their intake person kind of basically went through the same thing as the intake person at CMH. They asked us what was going on. We explained the situation. Same thing. He asked Ian, is this true? Ian said yes. He asked Ian if he had a plan. Ian said yes, I'm going to jump off a bridge. So he immediately had him taken back to a room. Once we were in the room, we were seen by a resident doctor on staff. She talked to us, went over the same exact story again. This is where he was at. This is what he has said he's going to do. She then asked if she could speak to Ian alone, which was fine with us. His dad and I left the room, and they spoke for about 20 minutes or so.
Was this person a psychiatrist or just a physician?
No, just a resident physician. It wasn't even an attending. It was a resident physician that they had on staff.
All right.
We were then taken back into a separate room, separate from Ian, where she talked to us and said that, you know, Ian was aware that we were trying to do the best for him and we had his health concerns, you know, at the forefront. And he did understand that, which was a lot more than a lot of kids that come in that kind of situation feel. She did feel that he had de-escalated, and her suggestion to us was that we take him home. We follow up the next day with his family doctor to work on changing his medication, and that we call his counselor and see if instead of doing a once-a-week meeting with his counselor that we could get him in more like twice a week or something like that.
Now, some of the listeners are keeping up with us. Ian took his life the very next day.
Less than 12 hours from us being released from McLaren Hospital, my son was dead.
So what do you think went wrong that he didn't get the help he needed?
I don't know. I wish I could give you that answer. He should have been seen by somebody in the mental health field. Somebody that knew. I mean, the resident doctor is just that. She's a resident. It wasn't even an attending physician. She didn't obviously take what we had told her seriously enough. When somebody tells you that they have a plan to take their life, they're supposed to be held, and they're supposed to be seen by somebody in the mental health field. That never happened to our son. Had that happened, my son may still be alive today. I know for sure he wouldn't have passed away on May 2nd.
What do you want people to know about your loss of your son, Ian? What do you think people should be talking about or asking for, or how should policy be changed? What do you want?
There's several things that I feel where the system kind of failed us. The first thing is private insurance. Private insurance should have to cover any disease or illness that can be life-threatening. mental illness is one of those diseases, and people don't like to talk about that, and they don't like to put it in the same category as cancer or heart disease. You don't have a cancer person come in and say, I'm sorry you have cancer, but we're going to let you go pass away on your own. Or you don't have somebody with a heart attack come in and say, I'm sorry you have a heart attack, we don't take your insurance, go give yourself CPR. You don't look at it like that. With mental health, if they have not made an attempt, then they are more than likely sent home, which is what we're getting from hearing other people talk about that. Because my son had not made an actual attempt yet, they didn't take that as an actual attempt because he had not physically harmed himself. He was sent home with us that night.
So we've talked about insurance. Were there other gaps in how the system worked that failed you?
Well, CMH, when we went there, I felt like they should have just taken him and at least done the psychiatric evaluation with him there, whether or not we had private insurance or, you know, state aid. The fact that we had to pay out of pocket to them was a great barrier. That shouldn't be how that's operated. It's a community mental health. They should give the help first and figure out how that payment's going to come in afterwards, because we would have paid anything we needed to make sure that our son was getting the help that he received.
While we've been talking, I noticed you're holding a small stuffed animal. Can you tell me about that?
This was Ian's. It was in his incubator, his crib at the hospital. And from the time he was born, it was with him every night. Until he was probably about 7 or 8, he decided he thought he was a little too old to have puppy in bed with him anymore. So it then sat on a little bench that he had in his room with a couple of other stuffed animals.
Julie Hartley is the mother of Ian Hartley, who died on May 2nd by his own hand. Thanks for talking to us about this gap in treatment for people who need this kind of treatment.
Thank you for having us.
We reached out to the two institutions mentioned. McLaren gave us a statement that reads in part, "Every day, more than a dozen people we care for in our emergency department are fighting to cope with a mental health condition. We create an individualized plan of care for each patient based on evidence-based practices and Michigan's Mental Health Code guidelines." The CEO of the Community Mental Health Authority of Clinton, Eaton, and Ingham Counties, Sarah Lurie, said due to confidentiality, she cannot discuss any particular individual situation.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Let's turn now to Dr. Cheryl King. She is a professor in the departments of psychiatry and psychology at the University of Michigan and director of the Youth Depression and Suicide Prevention Program. So, in a typical case, would you expect the state's Community Health Services Office to refer parents of someone threatening suicide to a hospital emergency room because of insurance? Does that make sense?
Does it make sense? It's unfortunate. But it's understandable in that our community mental health system serves primarily youth and families who do not have the resources for the private system.
Okay, so when an adolescent comes to an emergency room with a mental health emergency, what's the standard procedure for dealing with them?
If someone's coming in with any kind of psychiatric or mental health emergency, a full mental health evaluation with a careful look at possible suicide risk. Now, this is probably easier said than done because there is no one risk factor for there to be acute suicide risk. It's often a multitude of risk factors that cross biological, psychological, social, environmental domains. However, when someone comes in with that kind of emergency, the standard of practice would be to do a comprehensive risk assessment.
So a risk assessment, apparently some kind of assessment was done because Ian was given a score and it was low enough that it was decided that he should go home. Should a physician, do they have the qualifications to determine if somebody is threatening suicide, should be admitted or sent home, or should a psychiatrist be doing that?
So emergency departments generally work to triage patients. Sometimes they go for a specialty evaluation, or they order an X-ray, or they bring in a cardiologist. And sometimes they check a few things and they say, we're good to go. There's likely a triage in the emergency department with the emergency provider team. They're generally not mental health specialists. If they believe that there is elevated suicide risk and there is any concern for the youth's safety, they would generally then put in a request for a mental health evaluation.
You know, for Julie Hartley, the tragedy of her son Ian's death is made worse by what she sees as a failure in the state's mental health system. Do we have a failing system? I'm trying to figure out exactly what went wrong here, because the young man tried to seek help two different places with his parent right beside him and wasn't admitted anywhere and ended up taking his own life.
This was a tragedy. I mean, no family, no mother should have to go through what this family has. It is a failure of the system. This is a problem not only in Michigan, it's a problem nationwide. We do not have adequate resources in the mental health system, anything from adequate hospital beds if we choose to hospitalize a youth, adequate insurance reimbursement for outpatient treatment, and we probably don't have enough resources for optimal coordination of care. I believe it's a failure, not necessarily of an individual or a hospital, but it's a failure in our system right now. There's a new national effort called Zero Suicide. It's the National Alliance for Suicide Prevention, a public-private partnership, and their goal is no suicides among individuals seeking health care.
Why are we just now getting to this kind of a coalition when we've seen suicide rates among kids, teens, young 20s going up recently, and now even more recently going up in people in their mid-50s? I mean, suicide's been going up, and it's been going up a lot over the last two decades. Why are we just now getting to this point of taking it seriously?
Some of this has related to stigma of people not wanting to talk about and address suicide. We've had even many mental health professionals in training programs nationally with probably inadequate training related to recognizing and treating suicide risk. Then you get to emergency medicine and the training around mental health issues. We need to do more, and we should have been doing it sooner.
So if you had 5 minutes with the state's Community Mental Health Services office, the central office, which is under DHHS, what would you tell them you need to be looking at? What would you tell hospitals in the entire state? What do they need to be considering to help solve this problem?
It's such a multifaceted problem that we probably need a strong-arm approach with all providers and stakeholders tackling it. I think we do need more resources to family for the mental health needs of their children. We probably do need to do more with training. The state of Michigan currently has been funded by SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, to do more to tackle youth suicide in Michigan, to build coalitions, to work with communities, and to begin to also do a bit more that's upstream. In other words, rather than waiting till someone is at such high risk that they're talking about killing themselves, let's have more resources to recognize and identify those at risk before it becomes so acute. And that's right here in Michigan, out of the state of Michigan offices.
That's Dr. Cheryl King. She's professor of the Departments of Psychiatry and Psychology at the University of Michigan. She's also the director of Youth Depression and Suicide Prevention Program. Thanks for coming in and helping us understand this.
Thank you.
That's today's Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.